Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, the impact of technology and the internet on personal privacy has gotten a lot of attention lately. We're kind of hearing about, you know, large retail companies who are having their customer databases hacked and the implications that has for personal identity theft and that kind of thing. And, you know, Edward Snowden and the NSA spying story. You hear these things and you don't really know what to make of them in terms of their impact on you. I think, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, it used to be that people who were really worried about privacy online and in technology in general were sort of paranoid. But now I think average people are becoming more worried about that. But they don't know what to worry about exactly. So that's the reason for my show today, which I'm calling Is Privacy Obsolete? My guest is Laurie Andrews, who is a law professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology's Kent School of Law, and she's the director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology there. Unusually, as a lawyer, she's an expert on cutting-edge new technologies. She's very prolific. She's the author of 14 books, I think, on such subjects as cloning, surrogate mothers, and the selling of human tissue. And so you can tell from those topics that until recently, her area of greatest interest was the personal and social impacts of genetic technologies and reproductive technologies, including all of the complicated situations that technology has brought to the business of childbirth and parenting over the last 20 or 25 years. But now she's focusing on how social networks are changing our lives for good and ill. Her book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy, came out in 2012. Ms. Andrews is very versatile as a thinker and a writer. Some of her books are legal textbooks, and some are on ethics and policy, and some are nonfiction for the general public on these topics. And with all of that, Laurie is also the author of several mystery novels featuring a female geneticist and a military lawyer. She's our kind of guest on American Variety. Welcome, Laurie Andrews.
I'm delighted to be here.
Great to have you on. In this show, we're going to take a look at the internet privacy issues, right? So there was a time when, a long time ago, I don't know, maybe 60 or 70 years ago, when the biggest privacy concern for the average person was someone listening in on your conversation on what was then called a telephone party line shared by several customers. So a bunch of houses had the same phone number, and people could pick up their phone like an extension, and if they wanted to, listen in on your phone conversation, or else you could call the operator, and she'd patch you through to a number, and the operator could sit there and listen to your conversation. So that was the biggest thing people might be sometimes worried about in terms of privacy and technology back then. But we've come a long way. So, Laurie, can you list the privacy issues posed by technology today and what you think is maybe their order of greatest threat to us?
Our online selves have become more important than our everyday real-world selves, and judgments are constantly made about people based on what they're doing online. In fact, we're all carrying around miniature surveillance devices, our laptops, our cell phones, that can be used against us. For example, rental computer companies rented 400,000 computers to people without telling them that the rental company could turn on the camera on the laptop from their offices. And they did that and, you know, took pictures of people having sex and so forth. Marketing people have been able to turn on cell phones in order to record what people are saying to get more information about what they do, what they buy, whether they eat in restaurants, and so forth. So we have companies like Axiom, which they have, for 96% of Americans, 1,500 bits of information, everything from their credit scores to what medicines they buy. So we're in danger of being judged on these bits of digital data that we have no control over. If I do a Google search for a divorce lawyer, maybe for a friend, not for myself, or if I do a Google search for old guitars, I will actually get a less good credit card when I go to a credit card website on the belief not that I've done anything wrong, but that people as a whole who are in garage rock bands or who are getting a divorce are less likely to pay off their credit cards. So we have the biggest issue, collection of data about us without our consent. Then we have discrimination based on that data where we have no power to see it or correct it when it's not really about us. I represent children in pro bono cases, children with diabetes. So I'm constantly searching for things about the disease, things about the treatment in my Google searches, and yet life insurers can take that information, assume it's about me, and give me deny me life insurance or give me a higher rate for my life insurance. Some consulting companies have been telling life insurers that they shouldn't give life insurance to people based on things they post on their social network page, and that you should be denied life insurance if you're an avid reader, if you commute to work, or if you eat fast food, because all of those are thought to mean you're sedentary, you're likely to be obese, and that has really nothing to do with the individual's own health status.
In 2012, you published an op-ed piece in the New York Times entitled "Facebook is Using You." I think in that article you used the term data aggregation to describe what you're talking about there, where data of various kinds are aggregated for different purposes, like employment or credit or medical insurance coverage and stereotyping and so on. Is that the right term for what you were describing?
Yes, and there are big companies that are data aggregators. At the time I wrote the op-ed Facebook is Using You, people saw Facebook as very benign, Google as something you could trust, and actually they didn't realize that Facebook at that time made nearly $4 billion, 85% of its income from trading on your private information, so that if you posted about visiting Florida, they would then make money off of that information by having rental car companies and others post on your Facebook page. Google made 10 times as much, $40 billion, 96% of its income trading on your private information that it gathered from your Google searches. And so we thought we were the consumers of social networks and searches, but we actually were the product up for sale to data aggregators.
Yes, we become kind of like sheep being sheared as we use the internet. Let's break it down to the specific kinds of threats then. So like there's commercially driven privacy threats, which I guess involves cookies used in your browser that sites that you go to will insert there to show you've been there, and those can be read. And web tracking, which is another thing. I mean, talk a little bit about the commercial kind of invasions of privacy.
Well, it started out benevolently enough where Amazon put cookies on your computer to track what you like to read, or at least what you bought, and make suggestions to you, and so you wouldn't have to fill your password and address in every time. And so they put these tracking mechanisms that would help your experience. But then it got to be standard in the industry. As you pointed out, I've written 14 books. I love Dictionary.com. I didn't realize until I started looking into internet privacy that Dictionary.com puts 234 cookies on your computer from different entities that then track where you go. If you go to less expensive websites like bargain stores as opposed to a higher-end Saks Fifth Avenue type store, then judgments are made about you in terms of your credit worthiness and so forth when you try to use the web to do certain things, apply for jobs, apply for insurance, and so forth. So the idea is to categorize you based on what you've done anywhere on the web. And it gets interesting because just 2 years ago, about 35% of employers said that they would look at your social network profile before deciding whether to give you a job. It's now up to 92%. And what happens is that about half of them say they won't offer a job to someone who has a drink in their hand on their Facebook page, even if that person's an adult at a wedding and so forth. So doing perfectly legal behavior might be used against you and you'll never know about it. About 5 million Americans like a medical entity on their Facebook page, like the American Heart Association or the American Diabetes Association. But potential employers can look at that, be worried that you've got the disease, even if you only liked it because of a friend or you liked their race that you participate in, and then not even bother to call you in to interview for a job. So the sorts of things that it's impermissible for employers to ask you or credit card companies to discriminate based on can be gathered by these data aggregators and then used in ways that cause new forms of discrimination against people.
So it's really extreme kind of stereotyping and profiling in various ways. I mean, racially, gender, economic, ethnic, and you know, all kinds of ways that if they were done overtly in the workplace would be illegal, but to do it online is perfectly legal, and there's no, it's kind of a wide open frontier for that, isn't it?
It's a wide open frontier, and we haven't placed laws that protect you against actions by credit bureaus. The Fair Credit Reporting Act says that you have to be told if a credit bureau gives you a bad rating and causes a credit card company to turn you down, and you can correct information. But we don't have that about data aggregators. But some data aggregators make assumptions about you and your wealth and so forth on their websites, and they get around Fair Credit Reporting Act because they're not credit bureaus. They're just an entity that looks at where you go online. And yet, it can be used in the same discriminatory way.
What about identity theft, which is the thing that people, I think, were first worried about, you know, 15 or so years ago? Has that gotten more sophisticated, and is it something that people should be worried about more and more as time goes on?
Absolutely. There was a town in Florida where the cops thought that they had a great effort against crime because there weren't as many street crimes. Well, it turned out that what was happening was some of the street criminals were now driving around, going on people's wireless networks as they drove by and picking up enough information to file false tax returns with the IRS in people's names. And so then when the people went to file their own tax returns, the IRS told them, well, we already paid you. Or there was one person who moved into an apartment building and friended people on Facebook who were in the apartment building, and then he could see their Facebook pages. He then had all sorts of information about them. Think about what banks ask you as a security question. Hmm. A bank could ask you, what's your mother's maiden name? By looking at a person's Facebook page and seeing a picture of their mom with her name or a picture of their pet, what this gentleman did who moved into the apartment building was reset the passwords on people's banks and was able to steal money from them using that information.
Well, it used to be that the way to avoid that was just to put a password encryption on your router so that somebody couldn't drive by and pick you up from the street, but are there more sophisticated technologies now that'll let people who have bad intent do that more easily and get around that simple device of an encrypted router?
There are key loggers, so someone might send you a picture or a link to a website which actually downloads a bit of software that then allows them to collect everything that you type, including your passwords. We actually see that a lot in terms of divorce cases where each spouse puts key logging information on the others and surreptitiously collects information about their emails and so forth. Now, an increasing number of remote activation of software on people's computers, remote activation of your camera.
Mm-hmm.
And so some thieves remotely activate your camera by sending you something as an email. It might be a video or it might be just one pixel of a picture that then installs this. So they actually just then watch you type in your password. And as I mentioned, what some thieves do is actually reset your password. They don't need to know your password. They just contact your bank, press forgot your password. And if they can answer your security question, what's your mother's maiden name, what's your favorite color, what's your pet's name, which often they can do just looking at your Facebook page, at the public part of it. So they don't need to break encryption. A college student was actually able to reset Sarah Palin's email security when she was governor and give her a new password based on just information he got off of her public information about her. And then he posted her new password so everybody could go on and read her email.
Yeah, I remember that. And there's something I've heard about recently called man-in-the-middle attacks, where if you're in an internet cafe or any kind of hotspot and using your iPad or your laptop, or even your phone, someone there can, on the same router, in other words, can invade your device, and it doesn't involve the kinds of technologies that we're talking about before. It's a different thing, and I'm not clear on how they do that, but they can get onto anybody's device that's within range of that router in that hotspot. Then they kind of take over your computer and can turn it on and see, hear, even turn on your iPhone, for example, sitting on your kitchen table and hear conversations and that sort of thing. So it's really invasive and it's more common, and the providers of operating systems for those devices are scrambling to keep ahead of that, I think.
Yeah, the privacy invading technologies are far outpacing those that are protective of privacy. And some of it's coming first from the government sector. The government has had some products that they use in law enforcement where police drive around, and they have basically a fake miniature version of a cell tower. So the calls go through them and can be picked up. And, that's sometimes what's used in these man-in-the-middle attacks as well. And yet, we don't sort of want to give up our social media and so forth. In fact, it's become ubiquitous and addictive. I think about a case in which a man took a hostage as law enforcement people were trying to arrest him on a warrant, took the hostage woman into a hotel room and posted on his Facebook page, "Cute hostage, ha," picture of him with the hostage. And then in the course of a shootout with the police, actually friended 5 people and posted 12 status updates. And then his friends started posting on his wall, "Gunner in the bushes, watch out." And so the police burst in. The hostage was okay. But they're wondering whether they can charge the friends who posted information about their position on Facebook. So even in the midst of a shootout, someone may, you know, they can't move far away from Facebook. In fact, one criminal got caught because after robbing a woman of her diamond rings in an empty home while she was away, he opened up his Facebook page to check his messages and then left it open. So the police just went to his address when they arrived. So the power of being part of this community is very, very strong.
You're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm glad you're part of our community. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Lori Andrews, who's a law professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology's Law School and an expert on the interaction between technology and personal privacy. So we've been talking about all of the ways that the Internet can invade our personal space and our personal identity and privacy. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, or a couple of times, Facebook, and, you know, a guy who was just in the middle of a hostage taking and a shootout with the police is still updating his Facebook page between reloadings. I mean, that's just insane, that kind of addiction. But a whole lot of people are addicted to social media, if you can call it that. And I think it's probably a fair term to use for a lot of people. But what about some of the other ones like Twitter and Spokio? And are there some that are benign, like LinkedIn, which is more for business purposes? I mean, is there kind of a hierarchy or a ranking of how invasive some of these things can be? Talk a little bit about Twitter, for example.
Twitter has been better in terms of not sending information over to the government as readily. When the government asked Google for information, 93% of the time they turn it over to the government. And so you have a little more privacy in something like Twitter. You're a little better off on LinkedIn than Facebook just because people don't tend to put as incriminating things on their LinkedIn profile. So it's more of a self-selection there. In fact, there are certain websites that actually run continuous feeds of who's complaining about their boss on Facebook, who's saying they're using drugs, who's saying they're drunk. And it's a way to remind people that information can, you know, go out there in the world. And I think it's particularly problematic for kids who are 18 or 21 and looking for their first job. Some of them think, oh, they can clean up their Facebook page or that they've got privacy settings. But in most states, it's perfectly legal for potential employers to ask to see the private side of your Facebook page. Only a couple of states, I'm in one, Illinois, has a law that says that employers can't ask for your social network password. And there are companies like one called Social Intelligence, Inc., that actually sells the last 7 years' worth of Facebook posts to employers. So if you had things on your Facebook page anytime in the last 7 years, that might get you into trouble in some way. That is available through commercial companies that provide them to employers. 1 in 5 college admissions officers is now looking at people's Facebook pages in terms of college applicants. And I think that a lot of us think, well, you should know better, you should be more careful about what you post. But even something like a completely smiling picture of you could get you into trouble. In one case, a woman was injured at work. She needed several spinal surgeries. She had pins put in her neck. And the judge looked at her picture. It was actually on a MySpace page and said, well, she can't be that hurt if she's smiling in her photo. So you can't protect yourself against all the presumptions. I mean, people might have thought, well, what could possibly go wrong if my friend's pictures were shown as they are on Facebook? Facebook used to have a policy when people first signed up where they said, everything you post will only go to your friends. We're not going to make anything else public. And then in 2009, they made friends' pictures public. And it turned out there were some critics of the Iranian government in the U.S. who nonetheless had friends or relatives in Iran. And when those Facebook friend pictures became public, those relatives got beat up, got arrested, and so forth. But something as simple as your friends might get you into trouble, or a smiling picture. And so we really need protections against that information being used in negative ways. In Finland, you actually can't, as an employer, Google a potential employee. And that came out of an instance in which a man was offered a job, and then his employer Googled him and found he'd been at a mental health conference, took the job offer away. And he'd actually gone as a patient representative. He didn't have a mental health problem on his own. And so Finland said, listen, we're not going to have employers snooping around anymore into our private online selves.
Well, that sounds nice, and it would be great if there were laws against making these incursions into your privacy, but I have no idea how you'd enforce that. How would you prove that an employer had or hadn't looked at your Facebook page? I don't really get that. But are there other countries that have laws and try to erect barriers against this, and what's been their experience with it?
Well, I think some countries do have laws. The European Union in general has laws that operate in the following way. They say if any company keeps information about you, you have a right to see it. So a law student in Austria actually wrote to Facebook, and they had to send him what turned out to be 1,600 PDFs of things he'd ever posted, everything he deleted, things he deleted mid-sentence and thought had never been posted. And so that's a way in which you can monitor. You also, in Europe, have a right to correct what's there. And so if someone mistakenly thinks I have diabetes because I've liked the American Diabetes Association and then use it against me in any setting, I have a right to know about it. Right, it's not going to catch everything, but one of the important things about the United States is we were founded on an idea that you could reinvent yourself. You can declare bankruptcy. You can move out west and so forth. And here, what you've done as a 13-year-old can haunt you the rest of your life because it just stays on the internet forever.
I mean, all that works if it's full disclosure, but I think it just depends on the honor system, basically, of companies keeping records on what they do that they're not supposed to do, and I suspect many wouldn't, so it's kind of crazy. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was the founder of Facebook, and his sister, Randi Zuckerberg, recently wrote a series of children's books encouraging people to disconnect from social media. Must have made for an uncomfortable holiday season the next time around. But is the social media frenzy declining somewhat? Do you see any kind of reduction in this sort of addiction to social media that we were talking about?
Well, right now, Facebook would be the equivalent to the third largest nation in the world. It's got over 1 billion members, so it's only after China and India. So it's still very healthy in some sense, but I think that the privacy concerns are getting to be sufficiently acknowledged that some people are moving to Snapchat or other sorts of apps that are a little more ephemeral. Some are going off social media entirely. But nobody can really escape the internet. I mean, there are some scholarships you can only apply for through if you have a Facebook page. My doctor's office now makes me make my appointments online. And so you were talking about what remedies can we have. I mean, one thing is that we can have a do not track list, like the do not call list, where companies are forbidden from putting, you know, cookies on my computer and so forth. And how would that be enforced? Well, we could have random checks of people's computers. And if you see a bunch of cookies from those companies, you could then fine them a huge amount. I mean, I think that there have been a couple of surveys of Americans where a very high percentage of them say that they think companies should be fined, and about 92% of Americans say that companies should have to delete information about them if asked. But at least you could monitor the tracking mechanisms. You could say no tracking mechanisms unless I specifically opt in. Like if I go to Macy's and say, oh, I want you to be able to track me and get your coupons, but then I say no to all the life insurers and anybody else.
I suspect the train has left the station and is hurtling down the track and is not going to be a way to stop these incursions for commercial and data aggregation purposes and certainly from hackers into our private lives. So it's kind of the ball's back in the court of the individual, of the user, to protect themselves. So what's the answer, Laurie? we're all going to use our phones, we're going to use our, you know, our iPads, and we're going to go online. Is the answer to never go online again, or are there kind of some steps you can take to minimize your exposure? Is it possible to be careful in some way to avoid a lot of this?
There are ways you can search that makes data aggregation about you less less easy. You can download HTTPS everywhere by going on the website of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You can use things like DuckDuckGo as a search engine instead of Google. You can do ad block or disconnect. So there are certain easy mechanisms to prevent tracking. I know some defense lawyers who buy laptops in cash and never go on them from their home, use other places to connect than their office or home so they can maintain confidentiality about their trial tactics and so forth. But I'm also less pessimistic than you are, surprisingly. So much of my work is uncovering these abuses. It turns out that with every technology back 125 years to when the Kodak camera, the first instant camera, was developed, people have said privacy is dead. So when the portable camera was first developed in 1888, there were outlets all over the country that basically said privacy is dead because you used to be able to control your image by going into a studio, posing for a picture. And there was actually an op-ed that said now you could be caught in an uncouth position in line in the post office. And so rather than privacy being dead, we actually passed a ton of laws that talked about our right to protection against intrusion or seclusion. People couldn't come on our property to take pictures of us. We passed laws about, you know, what other sort of private information we should have control over unless we're a public figure and so forth. And then genetics came along and employers were turning down healthy people for jobs based on a genetic profile that said even though they were healthy now, they might be more likely to get cancer than someone else 20 years from then. And employers just said, you know, we don't want to take that risk. And it took 17 years, but a federal law got passed to protect privacy in that area. Ditto with wiretapping. It used to be that wiretapping was thought to be permissible, and then 40 years later, the Supreme Court finally said, no, we value privacy as a society. So we've had a bunch of areas where technologies were developed, we thought privacy was dead, new laws got passed.
Well, Lori, I hope your optimism is warranted, and we're not headed toward a Big Brother, Brave New World kind of scenario. But I want to thank you for being on with us in American Variety, and people can go to loriandrews.com, loriandrews.com, it's L-O-R-I, andrews.com, and you can go to socialnetworkconstitution.com and can get from there to her books. I mentioned she's a fiction writer, and to her YouTube channel, so socialnetworkconstitution.com. Thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety, Lori.
I'm honored to have been invited. Thank you.
It's been great. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.